Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio, our first new morning show of the new year. I'm Gregory Berg. I am always excited by the opportunity to reconnect with Mark Cushman, with whom I have had several wonderful conversations about a series that I like very, very much, and I know some of the rest of you as well, are big fans of Star Trek, the original series. Mark Cushman is responsible for a series of three different books about Star Trek, the original series, called These Are the Voyages, in which he examined each and every episode and also charted the development of each and every episode and takes us behind the scenes in a truly extraordinary and really revelatory fashion. Well, now Mark Cushman has, in a sense, done the same thing with yet another series, which aired roughly the same time and which was also a sci-fi series, but of a very, very different sort. And the series is Lost in Space. And it's quite intriguing to think about Lost in Space and to examine it seriously, since in just about every respect, it, at least overall, was not nearly as serious a series as Star Trek. It was cut from a very, very different fabric. But in fact, it actually began as a relatively serious series. I mean, relatively dark, and over time, I guess you could say, lightened quite dramatically. It took on a very, very different flavor, drastically different, in fact. And as we read these books that take us through Lost in Space over the course of its three seasons, through three volumes, we come to understand just how and why this series evolved and why it still has a fairly powerful hold over fans who liked it then and fans who have only come to it recently. So these books are collectively called Lost in Space, the authorized biography of a classic sci-fi series. I have volumes 1 and 2. As far as I know, volume 3 has yet to be released. And these are published by Jacobs Brown Press, as were Mark Cushman's earlier books about Star Trek, the original series. He is also responsible for a very interesting book called I Spy, a history and episode guide to the groundbreaking television series. Mark Cushman, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Hey, Greg. Wonderful to be here.
I'm so glad to be talking to you. I should remind our listeners that you and I had a conversation earlier this year, which surrounded the 50th anniversary of the airing of the first episode of Star Trek, the original series, and that was particularly fun. And before we start talking about Lost in Space, I believe, if memory serves me correctly, you are actually working on a fourth book about the original series. Am I right? Is that still on the drawing board?
Star Trek, yes. I'm working on that right now, which bridges the original series and Next Generation. That period of time when they were trying to get the show back, we were all waiting for the show to come back, and they offered us the animated series. There was the aborted Phase 2 series in the late 1970s, which became the Star Trek the Motion Picture. Gene Roddenberry's TV pilots from that period. And the reason I'm doing this book is because when we wrapped up the third, which was for Season 3 of the original Star Trek show, I tried to summarize where it was going. And the life that it took on, and how it was going to rise from the dead, and found out so much interesting stuff that had never been talked about before or never known before, And it just became too big, and my editor said, you know, this is a book by itself. There's so many odd turns and twists in this road as far as what was going on that people didn't even realize. We were all wondering, why isn't Star Trek coming back? It's so popular in syndication. Everybody loves Star Trek. Why isn't it coming back as a series? Well, there were a lot of very interesting answers about that that's never been talked about, so this is all going to be in this new book.
Oh, I look forward to that very much. I think even people who aren't fervent fans of Star Trek or Lost in Space might still have at least some notion of the real disparity between these two shows and the way that they were perceived. And in particular, generally speaking at least, if you were a fan of that original Star Trek series then and now, then chances are you had a disparaging opinion of Lost in Space, which was perceived as being quite juvenile by comparison, not nearly as weighty a series in terms of taking on various issues and so on. And so to whatever extent one sort of buys that summation, they might be really kind of shocked to know that that the same person is writing definitive histories of both those series, and that you have a great feeling of affection for both series. Just talk for a moment about your own personal connection to both Star Trek and Lost in Space. And particularly when both of these series were on at the same time, were your loyalties or interests evenly divided between them?
Well, no, but you know, Lost in Space came on 1 year before Star Trek. And I was, maybe 9, 10 years old. Loved it. My favorite show on TV at that point, because television for a kid was rather dull in that area, other than the TV westerns, which there were so many of them. At one point, almost half the shows on TV were westerns in the late 50s and early 60s, because the baby boomers were going to enjoy watching lawyer shows like Perry Mason or The Fugitive, as good as The Fugitive was. We wanted something a little more aimed towards us. So when Lost in Space came on and Voyage Beyond the Sea came on, they were immensely successful with kids, but the parents were watching too. They were both winning their time slot. So those were my favorite shows. Now, 1 year later, in 1966, Star Trek comes along, and I was a little late seeing that because it was on a little later at night. I didn't start catching it until the summer repeats in early 1967, and that immediately became my favorite show. I still watched Lost in Space out of loyalty because I had been watching it for a year and a half at that point, fell in love with that family. I think they felt like a surrogate family to a lot of us kids who were watching it, and there was just such a warmth to them in the series that it was hard to walk away from it. But it was getting more silly at that point. It was becoming not science fiction but fantasy comedy, and none of us understood why it was going through these changes. It was a popular show. As a matter of fact, in doing these books, I inquired the Nielsen ratings for every episode, as I did in the Star Trek books, and it's winning its time slot. So if it isn't broken, why are you fixing it? But they did change it, and it was interesting to find out the reasons for that.
I want to ask you another point of comparison question. One of the things about the Star Trek books, These Are the Voyages books, is that you were granted unprecedented and seems like unlimited access to this extraordinary treasure trove of archives of various people who were centrally involved in the creation of Star Trek, and that's how you were able to create such a rich historical record then.
Because you're talking about Gene Roddenberry, Bob Justman, Dorothy Fontana, everybody except Gene Kuhn, who was one of the producers on the series because he passed away in 74. But by having access to all of his memos, we get to know him, and you get to know him as you're reading the books. And because it really, you're listening to these four people and Stan Robertson at NBC talking about every episode as they're making it, talking about every script, the productions, and so forth. So you feel like you're in a room listening to them, sitting in the middle of all these people talking about next week's episode and what kind of problems are we having and why is this one so important to us and what are our differences about this between us, Roddenberry and his staff, and the network and the fights that they're going to have. So it's a very interesting thing to go through, and I was very fortunate to have those. And I think I know where you're leading with this. We had the same access with the Lost in Space show. I was given access to all of Irwin Allen's private papers by Kevin Burns, who's the shepherd of Lost in Space and all the Irwin Allen properties. So we know what he was thinking. We know what he was going through. We're reading CBS's memos. We know why they wanted him to change the show and so forth. And that's it. We get to be a fly on the wall for every episode of both of these tremendous series.
And that was, I guess, kind of a pleasant surprise for me as I first started exploring these books. That in fact you're able to take us behind the scenes of each and every episode to a similar extent, which is really quite fun.
And into the mind of Irwin Allen.
Absolutely, and I want to.
It's like a scary place to go at
right,
first, but it's
right.
Very interesting.
I want to ask you about Irwin Allen and have you kind of spell out something of his importance at this point in time in television history in particular, although his influence stretched even beyond the world of television. Give our listeners something, just at least a capsule sketch of sort of the length and breadth of his career, and then in particular the place he had in the world of American entertainment in the early and mid-1960s.
You bet. Well, this is one of the reasons I wanted to do these books, is nobody has ever written a biography on Irwin Allen. Nobody has ever gotten into his private papers. He didn't give a lot of interviews to tell you what he thought, like Gene Roddenberry did, traveling the college campus system and talking about Star Trek and so forth. So it was a great mystery. But if it wasn't for him, there wouldn't have been a Star Trek, because he opened the doors for science fiction and TV, and that's his greatest achievement right there. Now, to give you a full view of it briefly, he came, it's a true rags-to-riches story. This man came from the Bronx, came to Los Angeles with his cousin, didn't know a soul, and started this career and became an Academy Award motion picture producer. In a period of several years, he became a newspaper columnist. He became had his own syndicated radio show, invented the panel show, and things of that nature. And then he got into motion pictures and built his way up and started making these very unique motion pictures like The Lost World and Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and 5 Weeks in a Balloon, science fiction, fantasy, The Story of Mankind, things of that nature. He won the Academy Award for The Sea Beneath Us. All these kind of led their way to Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, if you can see that, the movie version, but also the sea beneath us, beneath us. And so what happened was there was no science fiction on television other than anthology series like Twilight Zone and Outer Limits. They had done some cheapies in the 1950s like Captain Video, but nobody had done a serious, big budget for that time, weekly science fiction show that took us into the future every week and required photographic effects and things of that nature. He went to ABC, and Fox was dead at that point because of Cleopatra and Something's Gotta Give with Marilyn Monroe, which never got finished. These two movies put Fox into bankruptcy, which is why they had to sell off their back lots and make Century City. So he'd been making movies for them that were quite successful. Suddenly he cannot. So he goes to ABC and says, I want to take that hit movie I've got, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, and turn it into a TV series. Their attitude at that time was, there isn't an audience out there who's going to tune in every week to watch a science fiction series unless it's an anthology. And even they didn't do that well. Outer Limits had just been canceled. Twilight Zone had just been canceled. And they'll cost too much. And he said, listen, I saved all three models of the Sea View, and the biggest one's 24 feet long. I saved all the costumes. I saved all the sets. We have stock footage of the Sea View and monsters and giant octopus and so forth that we never used in the movie. We used some shots, but we didn't use all of them. I can give all this to you for free and prove to you that this can be done and prove to you that there's an audience out there for science fiction. So ABC went for it. They just canceled Outer Limits. They gave the time slot for Outer Limits. Opening episode wins its time slot. Every episode in that first year wins its time slot. It's killing CBS. So CBS calls Irwin Allen and says, give us a show like this. Give us a weekly science fiction show. And he wanted to do Swiss Family Robinson in outer space. So he does Lost in Space. And it's winning its time slot from the very first episode. By the way, the budget he had for Lost in Space was only $145,000 an episode. Voyage to the Bottom Sea was $135,000 an episode. When Star Trek came on a year later, in 66, the year after Lost in Space, its budget was $192,000 per episode. So he had a lot less money to work with. He also had the restrictions of the family hour. All of his shows were on early in the evening. So censorship was much stricter as far as what he could do and the type of stories he could tell. And the networks were pushing him to target a young audience. And that brings in why the show changed. Mm.
You know, as we read the first part of the first volume that sketches the long career of Irwin Allen, you can immediately sense what a different person he was from Gene Roddenberry, who was, you know, really, let's say in some respects, quite a serious artist, concerned with a lot of very weighty social issues. And we just, even at a glance, as we look at the sketch of Mr. Allen's career, we, for instance, see we see faces like Groucho Marx and Frank Sinatra, and we see you know, images from the game show that you mentioned, and you can just tell he was much more of a kind of freewheeling entertainment man. That's what this was all about for him. So it's so striking to think about the two completely different sort of artistic or aesthetic paths which took Irwin Allen and Gene Roddenberry, in a sense, to very close to the same place at the same moment in time.
Yeah, well, Gene Roddenberry wanted to be a modern-day Jonathan Swift. He wanted to tell stories that were significant to what was happening right then, contemporary in the 1960s. But on network TV at that point, even in the later time slot that Star Trek had from 8:30 to 9:30, and eventually at 10 p.m., you were limited to what you could talk about. Back then, television said, look, if it's anything about topical issues, that's the news division. Entertainment's just supposed to entertain people, not make them think too hard. So he wanted to do stories about Vietnam, about racism, sexism, religion, all these things. And the only way he could do it was to do a science fiction and to disguise these stories that, well, it's not happening here between the United States and North Vietnam. It's happening on another planet between the Federation and a power that is representing of the North Vietnamese or Russia or China, and things of that nature, or the racism episodes. You may recall the one where the characters were half white and half black, and the reason they hated each other is because, well, you're black on the other side of the face, which seems like absurd, but it was brilliant, because at that time, when that episode aired in 1968, riots were happening all across the United States because of the assassination of Martin Luther King. Yet no entertainment shows could talk about any of this. And he wanted to talk about racism. And what makes it seem more absurd than I'm prejudiced against you because your colors are opposite as mine. So that was his goal and his mission, which had him butting heads against NBC, as you see in the memos in These Are the Voyages, on every episode, and getting the censors upset, which really led to the cancellation of Star Trek, because we have the ratings for every episode, too, and it was doing much better than we were ever believed it was doing. Now, Irwin Allen, on the other hand, just wanted to entertain people. He grew up a poor kid in the Bronx, didn't even have money to go to the movies, so he used his imagination to entertain himself. And he imagined going on adventures that you could not possibly go on to under the ocean or into outer space. So he wasn't looking to make any grand statements, but he wouldn't be allowed to anyway in those early time slots his TV shows had. But his whole thing was just to entertain you and give you a great escapism vehicle.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Mark Cushman, and we're focusing our attentions today not on Star Trek, as we have in the past, but rather on another sci-fi series from the 1960s, Lost in Space. And Mark Cushman has just released the second of a three-volume history of Lost in Space called Lost in Space, the authorized biography of a classic sci-fi series. So tell us a bit about the sort of entry that that Irwin Allen managed to make from a career that had largely been focused on film to the world of television. You've already explained some of the financial woes at 20th Century Fox that it, at least in part, prompted this move. I think some people might assume that such a move would be really tricky, at least in our day and age, where films tend to have lavish budgets, and one might move into the world of television expecting the same sort of lavishness to be possible. I think, in fact, we're talking about a scenario that's not really the same.
Right, and remember, Irwin was working in the most difficult genre to try to present on a limited TV budget and schedule. I mean, being given $145,000 an episode for Lost in Space was very little money, but even a greater enemy than that for production is the time. He had to shoot each episode in 6 days and get it delivered to the networks. The photographic effects would take weeks and weeks and weeks to do, but he had to get those done and get it to the episode or misses air dates, which is not allowed in television at all. So he was going into territory where no producer had gone before, and that opened the door for Star Trek. Now, you know, it's not that Gene Roddenberry was copying Irwin. It's very interesting, as I did my research for both shows, that the pilots for Star Trek and Lost in Space were filming at the same time. It just took Gene Roddenberry 2 more years to get Star Trek on the air than it took Irwin Allen to get Lost in Space on the air, and the reason was it's because it cost so much. His pilots were more expensive. Star Trek was more expensive, and he was telling stories that worried the networks, and they thought they would go right over the heads of audiences. So CBS embraced Lost in Space right away and put it on the air, and that changed television. So he's really a true TV pioneer. And I don't think we would have Star Trek today if it wasn't for him. It certainly wouldn't have been launched when it was launched with that cast and everything else that happened. It's that NBC saw that Irwin had a hit on ABC with Voyage Beyond the Sea, and he had a hit on CBS with Lost in Space, and they thought, we got to get in the game here. We've got this pilot we shot for Star Trek, 2 of them actually at this point. We better put it on the air. So that's what happened. But you mentioned before that to tell everybody how important Irwin Allen was, besides opening the door for all this, he was producing 3 TV series simultaneously, Voyage Beyond the Sea, Lost in Space, and The Time Tunnel. The next busiest producer in television was Quinn Martin, and as many series as he had throughout the 1960s, and we all remember a Quinn Martin production, it seemed like he had a lot of series on, but he never had more than 2 per year. Irwin was doing 3, and he was doing the most difficult genre imaginable, half a science fiction movie every week times 3. He was a workaholic, and he somehow did it. And that showed the networks that, look, these type of shows can not only be done, but they can be done within budget, within schedule, and they can attract a huge audience.
Right. One point in your book, somebody poses a question to Irwin Allen about why wasn't he married? And he kind of laughs at the notion, because I mean, he is just so taken up by this incredible
time.
Yeah, I mean, who would have the time to even think about such a thing?
It's hard to coming from television, I can tell you, Greg, it's difficult to nurture a marriage and raise kids if you're working on one TV show, even today where they only do 12 episodes a year on HBO or Showtime or 22 episodes on the networks. Imagine back then when you were doing 29 episodes a year and then doing that times 3 and the most difficult genre imaginable. No, he worked 7 days a week. And a couple people I interviewed told me his favorite day of the week was Monday because he loved work. And his worst day of the week was Friday because I got to go home. I can't work now. So he would, they all told me this. Everybody I interviewed said he would create crisis. So they all had to come out to his house on the weekend and work with him. that was his happy place, his happy element.
Wow. I was really fascinated by something you spell out, and this is while the series is still being, in a sense, formulated, not yet on the air, when he is asked by someone named Guy Della Scioppa, who this would be somebody, I think, at the network, is that right?
Well, Guy Del Scioppa was Red Skelton's partner.
Ah, okay.
And Red had a very successful show on CBS, the Red Skelton Show. And so to renew his contract, Red, that is, they said, look, we want to give you another hour on TV, and you can be executive producer, and you can be part owner of the show. So he put Guy on that, and Guy partnered up with Irwin Allen. And originally it was just going to be a TV version of Swiss Family Robinson. But Irwin, with his wild imagination, said, you know, let's do it Swiss Family Robinson in outer space. And again, Voice of the Sea was doing so well at that point, CBS said, hey, if you think you can do it, if you think you can actually do this on budget and on schedule, do it.
Right.
So I'll do it, but you can't put it opposite my other show.
Right. And so
they put it on Wednesday night. Massive hit.
Yeah. And what's interesting is he was asked, that is, Irwin Allen was asked to suggest the plot line of a pilot film, which would also be a typical episode for this new series, in order to, I suppose, give Mr. Della Scioppa a sense of how doable this is. And so So Irwin Allen responds with something, an episode that would be called No Place to Hide.
Right.
And it's quite elaborate, and it presented a lot of different scenarios that also probably never would have been permitted to be on a television screen in the mid-1960s. Just say a quick word about this, because it's really kind of interesting. It gives us a little insight into Irwin Allen's imagination and also a little bit of his audaciousness.
Well, you know, now it's very normal when you have a series, especially like an HBO series, House of Cards or things of that nature, Breaking Bad, to start at the beginning and introduce characters and develop it and take them deeper into what the series is going to be episode by episode. Back then, they said, no, we want the pilot to be a typical episode. We want to see what we're buying. We have to show it to the sponsors. They want to know what this is going to look like every week, not just to kick off, but every week. So even though we remember Lost in Space as having a proper opening where the Robinsons leave planet Earth and the reasons why, and Dr. Smith is a spy and he sneaks aboard the Jupiter 2 and sabotages it, and it ends up crashing on a planet and the whole thing. They didn't want to see that as a pilot script. So he wrote what could have been episode 10 and to show the network what it would be. Now, once they approved it, then he took those ideas and he structured them into the pilot, which launched the series, which again was unusual. I can't think of a single series from that era that began the way Lost in Space did. They never even reran those first few episodes, as epic as they were and as good as they were, because the network's thinking was so different back then. They thought, well, we get to the end of season one, now we're going to do some summer repeats. We can't go back and start at the beginning. We want to just continue where the Robinsons are and not confuse the audience. So the fact that Lost in Space had this five-episode arc which began the show, and if nobody's ever seen it, you should see it. It's all available on Blu-ray now, and it's a remarkable quality. You can even watch them with the network commercials. And it was just huge, and something we had not experienced on television before.
Talk for a moment about the fact that some other Space Family Robinson treatments had actually occurred even before Lost in Space.
There were a lot of legal hassles with getting that show going, because the film director who made, and I can't think of his name right now since I don't have the book in front of me, but he had done Robinson Crusoe on Mars, which did quite well. So I thought, well, I want to take another classic literature show and turn it into science fiction. And he had the idea of doing Swiss Family Robinson in outer space for the big screen at the same time that Irwin Allen was developing it for the small screen. There was also a comic book series on Gold Key Western Publishing called Space Family Robinson, which again was the same idea. And all three of these things launched right around the same time. Now, the movie never got made, but it was in development, and so it created a lot of legal hassles back and forth between the network and the owners of these other properties, claiming that Irwin Allen was ripping them off. And that's been rumored for decades. And by having access to his show files and going into all this stuff, I was able to find out the timelines to all these different things. And no, he was not taking it. These were all original ideas of his. And you say, well, how could three different entities come up with the same idea and pretty much the same title, Space Family Robinson? Well, because it's a natural high concept for television, and everybody was looking to classic literature, especially classic literature that was in the public domain, as Swiss Family Robinson was. You don't have to buy it. You can just adjust it and interpret it for television or for the movies or for comic books. And so it was a very attractive property for a lot of different entities. So it was kind of like a space race. Lost in Space became a space race to see who could get their product out first and claim ownership to it. And the reason they changed the title, Lost in Space, is because of the litigation that was going on between these other entities and the fact that the comic book got out before the TV show did, and it was using the title Space Family Robinson.
Right. We have not yet talked about the big thing. We've not yet talked about actually the all-star cast that populated this show. I think that's actually where we should go next, because
good. It will save the big thing for last.
Right. And I think it's really interesting, because I think when people think about Lost in Space, they don't necessarily immediately think about just how the sort of pedigree of this cast. And in fact, it was really an impressive group who all had really rich resumes. And in a sense, it's kind of amazing that Irwin Allen was able to assemble a cast of this kind of quality when one thinks about what the series was.
Yeah, because back then, a TV show usually had one known person, who had done a lot of TV guest spots and was up and coming, like Steve McQueen with Wanted Dead or Alive, but he hadn't taken off on the movie screens yet. Or Robert Culp, who did Track Down, so then they grabbed him for I Spy. And these were up-and-coming actors that they would give TV shows to. It was very rare that somebody came out of movies like Lucille Ball and so forth to do a TV show and gave up their movie career. And if anybody knows the story of I Love Lucy, they know that the reason she chose to do that, she was making all these popular movies with Bob Hope, but she was doing the radio version, which movie stars could do in that time. They could do radio, but not TV. It wasn't bad for their status. And she had I Love Lucy under a different title on CBS Radio. They wanted to move it to the network for television. And she said, if my husband can play my husband on the show, he doesn't have to travel the country with his band. He can stay home, and that will help the marriage. So that was her reason for doing that. But usually you're right. You didn't have stars. But it was Irwin Allen's way to always present all-star cast. If you look at his early movies before he did television, he was doing that with The Lost World, with The Voice of On the Scene movie, with 5 Weeks in Bloom, with The Story of Mankind. He would assemble these remarkable casts. And after TV, when he went back to the big screen with Poseidon Adventure, Towering Inferno, again, all-star cast. I mean, Towering Inferno with Steve McQueen, Paul Newman, just so many great stars in this movie, you'd wonder how he managed to do it. But he did the same thing for his TV shows, and Lost in Space in particular. Guy Williams had been Zorro on TV, and we traced the history of that show in the book as well.
Right.
That Zorro was an immense hit. But after 2 years, there was a dispute between Walt Disney and ABC, which caused it to be pulled off the air. And Walt Disney wanted to move it to NBC so he could start shooting it in color. And Guy Williams is on contract, and he's being paid every week to sit home, and he can't make this show. June Lockhart had just finished 7 seasons on Lassie. And right before that, she had had a film career and a stage career, and had done very, very well. Mark Goddard had 3 TV series prior to Lost in Space, which a lot of us don't remember. It's going back too far, but he was in a Western called Johnny Ringo. He was in The Detectives, starring Robert Taylor, and he was in a show called I think, Happily Ever After. I may be getting that title wrong because it was a short-lived sitcom that just went one season right before Lost in Space came on. Angela Cartwright had been in Make Room for Daddy for several years, seven seasons, I believe. And then she had done The Sound of Music. Billy Mumy was everywhere in TV. Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, you name it. And Marta Kristen had done some Disney movies and was doing a lot of commercials and a lot of modeling and so forth. And the last member, Jonathan Harris, had just come off of two series, The Third Man with Michael Rene and also The Bill Dana Show, which he had just finished before Lost in Space went on. So Irwin took all these actors who were very well-known faces on television and brought them together in one show. Had never been done before.
Right.
An all-star cast.
It really was something. I mean, for instance, the when you compare the casts of Star Trek and Lost in Space, I mean, now it's a different story. Now, basically,
Star Trek had one star, William Shatner.
Right.
Who had just had a series called For the People, was doing a lot of TV, even some films. DeForest Kelly was a fairly well-known character actor in Hollywood, but all the rest of them in the show, even though they worked a lot, they were kind of invisible. They
right.
They did a lot of different parts and shows, but we didn't know their names. So it built these stars.
Right, none of them.
Space used these stars to get attention and come out of the gate a winner.
Right. You mentioned Jonathan Harris, who played, of course, Dr. Smith. He is not part of the pilot episode. He is the last major character to be added into the mix. Explain the interesting sort of course of events which prompted him to be added to the lineup.
This is what's so rich about the story of Lost in Space, because when you have a hit show, you don't change it, especially that early in. Maybe if it's been on the air for 10 years and you want to freshen it up, but you don't take a hit show and change it immediately. And Lost in Space did this a number of times with its format, its casting, and so forth. So when Irwin made this epic pilot called No Place to Hide, and CBS immediately bought the show, why would you recast at that point? You got all these stars that are in the movie. The network has bought it. They want it every week. Why change it? But he and his story editor, Tony Wilson, got into a conversation, and they said, you know, every week they're going to be battling nature. They're going to be battling monsters. But they're not going to be battling themselves, because they all get along. They're a family. They all like each other. And although Major Robinson, Professor Robinson and Major West would sometimes butt heads, but you didn't have a lot of inner conflict built into the show, which is really the strongest type of storytelling, man against himself, man against man. And so they said, we need somebody inside the show who brings out conflict as well, kind of a Long John Silver. And that's when they got the idea of having Dr. Smith and having him program the robot and sabotage the ship and do all these things. But they had already locked in their cast, and everybody's contracts were in place. Guy Williams was going to get top billing and top dollar, followed by June Lockhart, followed by Mark Goddard, and so on. So how do we fit him in? And they offered Jonathan Harris the show, which was a brilliant addition. And really became he became the most popular character on the show, him and the robot, curiously enough. And so Irwin offers him the job, and he says, but I'm going to have to give you seventh billing. I just had two hit TV shows. What do you mean? I'm getting seventh billing. So they came up with the idea that it will be special guest star. It had never been done in TV before, but he would be the last name to come up in the credits, but he would have that special above his name. And there's a second reason for that, Greg. They weren't sure if the character was going to stay because he was so bad. He was trying to kill the kids. He programmed the robot to even kill the kids. How do you keep a character like that on the show, especially as dark as Lost in Space was when it first premiered? It was kind of like film noir science fiction. So they didn't really think the character was going to stay. They were going to use him as a catalyst to get the show going. They would have liked to have kept him in, but they didn't really see how that would work, and the network especially didn't see how that would work, and that brings us up to the big surprise.
Right. Before we get to that, I want to ask you about the way in which each of these episodes, as you examine them, the way you did with These Are the Voyages for Star Trek, among other things, you not only tell us, you know, who was cast as the various aliens and different things that happened with the production. Yeah. But you also trace the evolution of each and every script. One thing I noticed, one of the things I love the most about These Are the Voyages is really tracing how these scripts took shape, and for the most part, how in the expert hands of various people, these scripts would dramatically improve until their finished product.
And hearing their conversations.
Yeah,
their
absolutely. Just incredible. Now, in this case, with Lost in Space, in most cases, we see that these scripts all undergo revisions. But very, very often, we don't see specific names attached to these various revisions. And we also get a sense that the process of revision was not the same as it was with Star Trek, the original series, in terms of working towards a greater and greater artistic achievement and dramatic achievement. The revision process was somehow something else with Lost in Space. Just say a quick word about that.
Well, you know, again, back then you had small staffs on TV shows. Now if you watch a TV series like House of Cards, watch the opening credits, which we really don't even watch because they're laid over the first part of the episode as dialogue's going on. But you'll see 10 producers listed. These are all producer writers. They're all the in-house staff that's rewriting all the scripts. Back in those days, it was all done by freelancers who would go from one show to another. And so they come onto a show like Star Trek or Lost in Space. They don't even know what this thing's going to be. It hasn't even got on the air yet where I'm supposed to write a script for it. So you need somebody on the inside who's going to rewrite these scripts, make the characters sound like they're supposed to sound, and keep the flavor of the show intact. Well, in Star Trek, it was Gene Roddenberry. He was rewriting all those scripts and doing about 70% of the dialogue in every script, even though we saw a different writer's name on the screen. And when he finally got burned out, Gene Kuhn stepped in and started doing it, and so forth. Well, on Lost in Space, it was Tony Wilson. Anthony Wilson was has screen credit read. He was story editor, like Dorothy Fontana was on Star Trek and so forth. And it was his job to take all these stories that he and Irwin had assigned and nurture them along with the writers as far as he could, and then go in and do a script polish to make sure that all the characters sounded right. And so they're unsung heroes, these people who were doing all this rewriting. Their names went on the screen, but kind of in the back credits, story editor. They didn't come on the front, written by this guy and this guy. They didn't take that credit. They were getting a weekly paycheck. They were getting the back end credit as story editor and doing all this rewriting. And it was Wilson working with Irwin who came up with the idea of putting in Dr. Smith and the robot and so forth. And then when CBS started leaning on them to change the show, it was Wilson's job to change it. And here's another little surprise. It was Jonathan Harris who was doing a lot of rewriting on these scripts as well. Because for him, it was life or death. He knew the network wanted him off the show. Even though the show was a hit and everybody understood his character was very important for that, he understood that he wasn't going to survive if the scripts didn't start getting changed. So he got involved in the rewriting process, which is very rare in television, especially back then, that one of the actors in the show gets to have hands-on influence on each script as it comes down the chute.
Hmm. Well, I wish we had more than 5 minutes to talk about one of the most interesting points, and maybe we'll have another conversation someday to talk about this in even greater detail, but we need to talk about the dramatic shift in character of the series and explain to our listeners why Batman had something to do with this.
Yeah, even before Batman came on, the shift was starting to happen. The fans of Lost in Space who've seen these episodes, or if you're reliving the episode as you read the book and watching the Blu-rays, you'll notice in the first season, it is remarkably dark. As I said before, film noirish science fiction, black and white, very moody, very scary. And the memos that we see from the network on each episode is you cannot put children in peril during the family hour. You've got to quit putting these kids in such peril. And especially with this character, Dr. Smith, especially with the robot who's been programmed to kill them if he finds them alone on this planet somewhere, make it look like an accident, a heart attack, something along that line. So the censors keep fighting Irwin, and Jonathan Harris sees this happening. He sees his opportunity, so he starts adding humor into the character of Dr. Smith. And he thinks, if I can succeed in doing this, I can probably keep my job. And he's being paid very well. He doesn't didn't want to go off the show after 9 episodes. So it starts going through its evolution, even in the first season. But then, halfway through the first season, Batman premieres on ABC opposite Lost in Space. It's been winning its time slot every week. Suddenly it's coming in number 2 against Batman. And the 60s are changing. America, pop art is coming in. The whole flavor of America is changing. So Lost in Space said, let's not fight it. Let's join it. And let's go along with the trend. We're going to go color next year. Let's really dazzle people. Let's surprise people. Let's bring in more fantasy, more comedy, which will get the network off our backs. Because even though the kids are still being put in peril, we're not taking the situation as seriously, so it won't feel as dark to them or as threatening to them. And that's the reason for the changes. Irwin Allen didn't want to change the show. The network did. And he went along with the plan because that keeps the show on the air.
It's really amazing. And, of course, if people have only seen those later episodes, they forget about where this series started, and it's so important. As you were writing this book, did you, I mean, and maybe this is a dumb question, but I'm just curious. Did you, in fact, I'm just curious if you, in fact, rewatched each and every episode of Lost in Space, and assuming that you did, what did that feel like to return to a series like this that I assume over the intervening years you'd scarcely watched at all?
It was a very interesting experience, Greg, because Star Trek, I had kind of kept up on it. We all did. You know, you're flipping channels and there's Star Trek. Oh, the great episode, The Tribbles, or whatever it's going to be, City on the Edge of Forever. And you watch it again, or you have the DVDs. Lost in Space had been out of sight for me as a person, probably for a lot of people, for many, many years, decades even. So when the Blu-rays were released, and they did such a fantastic job remastering these episodes and the bonus materials and everything else, you know, I picked up the copy, and I was already working on the book, and I started watching these episodes in chronological order, which I always tell the readers of the books to do, because you're watching the series develop over a three-act structure, in a sense. And I was surprised at how enjoyable they are, because, you know, you forget about all the CGI and everything that we've seen that's changed. There's an innocence to the show, but it's pure drama. And even comedy is drama. It has a dramatic structure. And so you don't have all this technology getting in the way of telling the story of these characters, of this family trying to survive out there. So I found the first series, in particular the first season, incredibly enjoyable. But when it came to book two and season two, I thought, okay, am I going to be able to enjoy these as much, especially after doing all the Star Trek research and work and knowing that show as well? And it's a very different flavor, but they're very entertaining. And each one of them is a little morality play, just like in Star Trek. They're using a lot of fables that from ancient times that they're bringing into these episodes, the Midas touch and things of that nature, where Dr. Smith is able to wear this collar that an alien gives him, and everything he touches turns to platinum, which King Midas, in this amazingly dramatic scene where he touches Penny, and she turns to platinum. And he becomes so hateful of himself for doing that to this sweet little girl. It becomes very dramatic towards the end, and a great acting turn for Jonathan Harris in that particular episode. So watching these shows, I was surprised that they are tremendously entertaining, which is, Greg, the reason why Lost in Space is coming back.
Well,
Hollywood's figured this out.
Right. In the meantime, we can explore this series further with the first two volumes of your history and a third volume on the way. Irwin Allen's Lost in Space, the authorized biography of a classic sci-fi series published by Jacobs Brown Press. Mark Cushman, thank you so much for your time. It was great to reconnect with you and to talk about Lost in Space. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg. Bye-bye.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Mark Chernick is going to be talking with us about the importance of personal websites and websites for your business and some of the things that perhaps one should consider.